Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Adam Gopnik. Adam Gopnik was born in Philadelphia and raised in Montreal. He is best known for his work at The New Yorker, where he has written about Mark Twain, hockey, dogs, Icelandic coffee, Babar, snowflakes, magicians, the Jets, and spirituality, among other things. He served as the magazine's art critic from 1987 to 1995 before moving to Paris with his family and contributing to the magazine's Paris Journal. The French newspaper Le Monde praised him as a witty and Voltairean commentator on French life. His essays were expanded and published in his best-selling book, Paris to the Moon. After a five-year stint in France, Gopnik and his family returned to New York, and he began publishing about life in the city. This led to his second collection, Through the Children's Gate. Gopnik has won the National Magazine Award three times, as well as the George Polk Award for Magazine Reporting and the Canadian National Magazine Award. In a profile at Gopnik's Massey Lecture in Canada, David Baird wrote, "Gopnik is an aesthete, but unlike many of his fellow students of the 15th century Italian painting, he is not an elitist. He is an aesthete of ordinary and intimate pleasures." Now, from the 2015-2016 season of Portlots and Lectures, here is Adam Gopnik speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I had a wonderful morning this morning. I went out to Grant High School. Yes. And one of the things that I loved about being out there, one of the things I generally love about having a chance to talk to teenagers, talk to kids, is that I'm fascinated, and I want to talk a lot tonight. I'm going to tell some stories about the ways we communicate or fail to communicate with our children and our teenagers at various ends and beginnings of their lives. You know, one of the things that's true, one of the things I write about a lot is having kids. I've got two kids. They're a little bit older now, 20 and 16. But I've written a lot about them as they've grown up. And one of the truths, one of the fixed truths about kids is that at the age of 13, no matter how good a parent you've struggled to be, no matter how good a parent you have been, at that moment, the human genome kind of clicks on magically, and you become, at that moment, the most ridiculous, embarrassing, and annoying person on the planet. It's those three things at once. You're embarrassing, you're ridiculous, and you're annoying. And the most you can do, I've come to believe, is to eliminate one of the three as an accurate descriptor. So you have to be able to look your kid in the eye and say, I may be embarrassing, and I know that I am ridiculous, but I am not annoying to you. And it sort of comes down through the generations, if you think about it at all. Our grandparents, typically, were embarrassing and annoying to our parents, but they weren't ridiculous. Mine weren't. They were immigrant people. When they were young, old Jewish people, they were still old Jewish people. They were embarrassing and annoying to my parents. They weren't ridiculous. My parents were endlessly annoying and completely ridiculous, but they weren't embarrassing. You would have people come over and they would say, "Oh, I just had the best talk with your mother." And you'd say, "With my mother?" But it was true. They weren't embarrassing. And we generationally are the most embarrassing generation there's ever been because we do not understand that we have aged. And we don't understand that we are, in fact, no longer 20, that our tastes in music are no longer the tastes of the world, and so on. We are embarrassing, and we're utterly ridiculous in our failure to understand, A, that we are embarrassing, but we're not particularly annoying as a generation because we do anything our children ask. Wherever they want to go, but however they want to do there, "Dad, could we go to London to see a Blur concert?" "Sure, that sounds like a good idea. Let's go and do that." We're not annoying, we're embarrassing, and we're ridiculous. When my son Luke turned 13 and discovered that I was embarrassing, ridiculous, and annoying, it took a particularly painful turn for me at first because we had been very close through the years. If any of you read some of my writings from Paris, city of Paris, he grew up there. We kind of grew up together, me trying to become a Frenchman, he trying to become a human being, and we went very similar processes. And we moved forward together. At 13, that same genome switched on, just hit. And I found myself, for the first time, Luke wasn't eager to speak to me, wasn't eager to talk to me, wasn't eager to have the conversations that we'd had together for so long and with so much joy. And the problem is that you know that this is age appropriate, as the sociologists and psychologists tell you, but you still can't handle it. I work at home in a little room in the back of the apartment. I write all day. And 3 o'clock would come, Luke's knocking the door, and I would go and greet him. And, you know, it's sort of, there's a sense in which the age of 13 and your interactions with your kids at 13, it's sort of like the tragedy of parenting. It's like the Greek tragedy of parenting, because there's this invisible Greek chorus that lines up behind you. And when your kid comes home and enters with that kind of hooded look that 13-year-old kids possess, and you hear the Greek chorus of parents behind your head, and they say, don't ask him that question, don't ask him that question. And you hear it, but you're sort of like Oedipus, you're doomed anyway by fate, and you say, how was your day? How was school? And the parents are saying, this is the wrong question to ask, and you know it, but you can't help yourself. And Luke would kind of walk by me with that 13-year-old grunt and go into his room. Shut the door, and I would be sort of crushed because I wanted to connect with him. Well, one day, he did that. He came in, disappeared, and I went back to my office, and I was writing, and suddenly, I hear a little ping, and I look down, and there's an instant message from Luke, who's 20 feet away in his room. And the instant message says, hey, Dad, what's up? So I bend over my keyboard, and I write back, I don't know, Luke, what's up with you? And he writes back, oh, everything is good, some stuff at school. And then he begins to explain to me all the things that he had denied me 5 minutes before at the door. And this fascinates me, that something about the act of writing instant messaging, like texting, liberates him to have some kind of conversation with his father. And I realize that this is the only way in which he can communicate, is through a keyboard rather than through face-to-face conversation. And this fascinates me, right? Because it's so generational. The entire world of 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds are now, we only see the tops of their heads as they bend over and their thumbs work. I haven't seen anything except the top of my daughter's head for 4 years now. Now, the question, here's what fascinates me in the first instance. First of all, is why should this be so? Why should the act of writing, of texting, words be so much more powerful and appealing than actually talking to somebody face-to-face? And I often think that it's purely an accident of the sequence of discovery. And by that I mean that had the text message come first, had Alexander Graham Bell invented the text message in 1890, so we had been text messaging each other all of that time, instant messaging and text messaging. And then had Steve Jobs invented the phone call in 1994, all of our children would be on the phone all of the time. And we would be trying to text them and instant message them, and they would be rejecting it. I mean, you can just see what that would be like. You could see Steve Jobs making the announcement, finally, your thumbs are free. You can see the giant Apple ad. Free your fingers. Hear your girlfriend's voice. Hear your mother's sighs. It would be a revolution in technology. And Apple would make another $10 billion. And all of us who grew up texting would be left on the other side. I think it's generational sequence as much as anything. But then I realized there's something else to it as well. It's about autonomy. If you're writing and you're sending the text message, you have autonomy against your father, and you're on even terms, that you're equalizing as you come through the door and into your room. So Luke and I started texting and instant messaging each other every day when he came home from school. And it got to be almost Japanese in its formality, because the doorbell would ring, I would open the door, we would bow at each other, he would go into his room, and I would go into mine, and 5 minutes later, we would begin a conversation. An instant message. And he taught me all of the abbreviations and all of the language of instant messaging. BRB means be right back. SYS means see you soon. It was one, though, that he didn't have to teach me, because it appeared at the end of every message he sent me in response to my giving him good lessons and good advice about the world. I would give him a little good advice, and he would write me back. And he didn't have to tell me what it meant because it was so clear. LOL was how he ended things. And I knew it meant lots of love because it was so transparent that that's what he was saying. I'd say, just remember always, darling, that you just have to do the things you have to do in order to do the things you want to do. And he would write back, LOL. And I knew that I was imparting advice for which he was deeply grateful in the center of his being. And I was proud of him for being able to express his affection that way. And I thought there was something so beautiful about being able to encapsulate, abbreviate in stenographic form so much emotion in three simple letters that I began to use it as kind of my signature greeting to the people I cared for. So, you know, my friend got fired and I would say, you know, we're all on your side, LOL, Adam. My sister was getting divorced. So I wrote her and said, you know, we're behind you and beside you, LOL, your brother. It's true, true. Well, finally, months go by in which I'm sending out LOL to everybody in my life. And I'm sitting in a gate at LaGuardia Airport, and I'm writing to Luke, I'm texting Luca, saying to him, you know, I hate the fact that I have to travel so much and go so many places. I'm not with you as much as I wish I was. But I do it because it lets our family go on, lets our family live well, and I have to do it that way. LOL, Dad. And I suddenly get back from Luke in giant caps, as though there's an incoming message from NORAD, Russian planes have been spotted. It says, Dad, what do you think LOL means? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. And I say, lots of love, obviously. And he says, what you all know, he said, no, Dad, it means laughing out loud. And I felt stricken beyond belief. Because not only had I been misusing it, but now I was going to have to rescind a year's worth of LOLs from all the people that I had sent them to. I was going to have to repeal, take back all of that love that I thought I had been sending when in fact I had been ridiculing and mocking all the people I cared for. But then something funny happened, something strange happened that I think is true about the relations, the communication between parents and children, one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight. And that is, as time went on, Luke and I kept using LOL as the greeting, and we left it undefined. We left it undefined. So that to this day, when I'm away from home and I'm out of town, I'll say, take care, Luca, LOL, Dad. And he'll write back, okay, Dad, LOL, Luke. Because if you think about it, we all live in that ambiguity, don't we? We all live in that twilight zone. Because if you think of it, there are very few moments, very few relationships in life where saying, I'm laughing out loud in your presence and saying, I love you a lot, don't really mean the same thing. They cross over. They blend. They are, in effect, the same emotion expressed in two different ways. So we go on LOLing each other in this strange netherworld of ambiguity. And it doesn't matter what it really means. It means what it means to the two of us. Well, that's one story about children, about communicating with children. The other problem that comes up in families, of course, is how you communicate with your spouse. That's the other big one. That's the other troubling one. My wife, Martha, never travels with me because she doesn't want to. But she is actually, for the first time ever, here with me tonight in the front row. And I'm incredibly pleased. I insisted that she come because I wanted to drink red wine and coffee with her here in Portland, and we've been doing it. And we've been married a very long time. We've been married a really long time. I won't even tell you how long we've been married because she doesn't like me to mention it, but the phrase, the Ford administration, enters into the accurate description. of our relationship. That's when we met. We've been together for a long time. And one of the things that's always striking to me about long marriages, my family's filled with long marriages, really long marriages. My parents have been married for 60 years. You can imagine it just now. They celebrated their anniversary. We all went up to Maine to celebrate. None of us actually lives in Maine, but Maine seemed like the right place to go to celebrate somebody's 60th anniversary. And one of the things I've noticed, coming back to the subject of food, one of the things I've noticed is that what happens in a long marriage is not that you don't have arguments. That's an illusion. That's a fiction, that you can be married for a long time and be harmonious, never have an argument. No, the thing about long marriages is that you have the same argument over and over and over. One good argument lasts a lifetime in a marriage. And the key to having a long marriage is finding that argument early and never letting it go. Now, in my family, because everyone is a fresser, which is a Yiddish word meaning an eater, we drink, we eat, that's our obsession, almost all the long-term arguments are about food. Almost all the arguments are about food in the good long marriages, the kind of a good argument that can last you forever. Because if you think about it, and this is one of the other themes along with red wine and coffee in my book about food, The Table Comes First, if you think about it, the thing that makes food so astonishing as a item in our lives, why it matters so much, is that every mouth taste immediately becomes a moral taste. It's not just that we eat for pleasure, it's that what we eat, what we choose to eat, we immediately translate into an ethical imperative. God reasons this way, right? God doesn't like bacon, so he says it's evil to eat bacon, right? Doesn't like the taste of it if you're Jewish. We always are taking our mouth tastes and turning them into moral tastes. And if you do that, you can have a really good argument. I think, for instance, about my Uncle Ron and my Aunt Rose. They had one argument for 70 years, as long as I ever knew them. And here was what the argument was. It kept their marriage alive and young. She said that they charge you more at restaurants. They have to charge you more at restaurants because they give you large portions. And he said they give you larger portions in order to charge you more. They kept this argument going for decades and decades and decades. It was like something out of a Samuel Beckett play. I'm telling you, Ron, they have to charge you more. The portions are so big. You're crazy, Rose. They're giving you the big portion in order to up the price. That's why they want to charge you more. On and on and on. It's a beautiful argument. Kept a marriage intact. My grandparents had one argument about food. Always. My grandparents, it's actually an odd story. No one ever believes, but it's true, that I introduced my grandparents. And this is true, because what happened is that when my parents got married, they each had a favorite parent. My father liked his father, and my mother liked her mother. And when I was born, they finally started spending a lot of time together. And eventually, my father's father divorced my father's mother and married my mother's mother. That's true. And as a consequence, I grew up with a kind of cartoon version of my parents living in Florida. They had exactly the same characteristics as my parents. They just were a little more broadly painted. And we'd go down and see them. The argument they always had was that my grandfather's English was sort of imperfect. He had come to what he always called this country relatively late, in his late teens. And not only was his command of English imperfect, his command of English idioms was imperfect. And he couldn't understand a lot of expressions we used about food, and my grandmother would never explain them to him. So when he was 88 and we went down to show him our son, Luca, he took me off in a corner and said, "Adam, there's something I want to ask you, something that your grandmother has never explained to me." And I thought, what can this be, right? And he said to me, "When people say you can't have your cake and eat it too, what do they mean? What else are you going to do with your cake?" It's good. Yeah. Well, you can see what I'm leading to. Martha and I have had one argument in our entire long marriage, and that's about rare and well-done meat. I come from a family where rare was an ethical necessity. because they were rejecting their own immigrant past, and the rarer you had something, whether it was tuna or beef or anything else, the more you were showing that you were in aggressive connection with nature and with France and with the way things should be done. Martha came from a family that believed that the longer you incinerated something, the more you showed the elevation of your civilization. She comes from a Scandinavian family. And when I first knew her, you know how that is when you're courting, you don't actually believe that the words you hear have content. So she would say, we'd go out for dinner, and she would, how would you like it? Well done. And I thought, oh, that's charming, right? That's like someone saying, who's your favorite singer? And she says, Donny Osmond, right? And you realize, what a complicated, elegant joke that is. And I felt the same way about hearing her say, well done. It's a great, complicated, elegant, slightly campy joke. And then I went for a grill, a barbecue, in the backyard of the house in Montreal where she grew up, and I realized it was real, because her father had hamburgers out on a grill, and he was grilling them. 5 minutes went by, 10 minutes went by, 15 minutes went by, the moon rose and the sun sank. And as Scandinavian people will do, as I'm sure some of you know, until it was in the condition of a hockey puck, he was not happy. And they all ate these things with enormous pleasure. We moved out. We began our life together. And we have a slightly weird reversed marriage because we both take on gender roles that are not normally associated with the gender. Martha does all of the banking and all of the business stuff in our family, and I do the cooking. She also does all the driving, and I find myself, until very recently, in what used to be traditionally the mother's seat. I am the one who passes the cookies back and says, shh, your mother's trying to find the exit, and does all of those things. But I cook. And I realized when I would offer her a steak or a burger or tuna done the way it should be done, pink and rose and a little almost raw on the inside, and she would make a face, I realized that my annoyance, my anger, was primarily sexual. Because there's no question about what that means, pink and red and raw and all of those things that you're offering someone, and when they reject them, it's clearly an erotic denial that is being thrust down you. And when I say, this became a real issue between us, and she would say, well done, at a restaurant, I would give her the ray, you know, the way you do when you're married, and I would say rare, and she would shoot it back to me. It looked like we would have a good 50 years of arguing about this, but we would end up like Aunt Rose and Uncle Ron. Came to a head one terrible night when I brought back some beautiful sort of sushi-grade tuna, and I did it in a cast iron pan with Cajun spices, really nice, and I served it to her and the children. And they all made faces because they were learning from her what to like. And I got up from my seat, the only time I've ever done that in all of our marriage, I got up from my seat and I headed for the door. Isn't that a terrible thing? But I did. That's how upset I was. That's the insult I felt simultaneously to my culinary tastes and to my masculinity that I was being offered by my family. And she stopped me at the door and said, you cannot do this. You cannot do this over tuna. And I came back to dinner. And then, you know, the other good thing that happens in a long marriage is that you arrive at negotiated solutions without anybody having to say what the formula is going to be. It's like when nations actually get along, they don't actually have to negotiate, they sort of know. It's like Canada and the United States. In Canada, we sort of understand you, you sort of understand us, and so on. And what began to change was that Martha landed on a beautiful, a wonderful, a peaceful, a beatific, a soul-saving word. And that word is medium. And medium is such a beautiful word if you think about it, because medium can go in any direction. Medium well, medium rare. So when the waiter comes over and says, how would you like it done, ma'am? She can say, medium well. And I don't even have to hear the well officially, right? It's a side issue. And I can echo it. I can say medium rare, and she doesn't have to hear it. We live in medium and then silently and privately choose either extreme. And I began to do something, too, at the same time. While she seized on medium as a way of resolving our conflict, I realized that there was a simple answer for me as a cook, and that was to stop sautéing everything and braise everything instead. Because if you braise everything, then the question of rare and well done never arises. You braise things for 10 hours, 12 hours. Then the only question is the central question of a long marriage, and that is tough or tender. Because that's the real question. Rare and well done is about the erotic early years of your marriage. Tough and tender is about the later family-raising child years of your marriage. We move from that world of contested, rare, and well done into the happy medium of tough and tender. And we have resided there ever since. That's all I do anymore is make stews, and all she does when we go out is whisper medium to the server. And we find our happiness in doing that. Because the secret of a long marriage, beyond finding that one good argument to have, is that if you continue that work, as we try to and as we're doing, then the truth is it doesn't really matter anymore. The truth is you can have larger and larger portions and pay less and less for them every time they come. And that's what makes a marriage work. So thank you, Martha, for being here tonight. So I'm writing a series of stories about my first jobs in New York, and I had the strangest collections of jobs anyone ever had. And this is a story about the time I had a job giving gallery lectures at the Museum of Modern Art. There's a lot of art in it, and I'll stop and explain some of it as we go. After I lost the sort of job I had at the Frick Library, that was the first job I had, after I lost that job, I got a job sort of at the Museum of Modern Art talking about old pictures that had once been new. Those were, and probably still are, the two kinds of jobs you get when you're a newcomer to the city, the sort of job and the job sort of. A sort of job is one that's really a job, but that you don't really want to do. A job that no one would really attempt if they had a choice. People worked for years at the Frick Library, but no one was really lifted by the experience. A job sort of is a job that could be good if you actually had it, but you don't really, not in the way that normal people have real jobs. These days, those kinds of jobs are called internships. But 30 years ago, though they might ask you to do something for almost nothing, they didn't quite yet have the nerve to ask you to work at something for nothing at all. The job I got at the Museum of Modern Art was like that. It wasn't really a job. You couldn't live on what you made doing it, but it was still fun to do within limits. Three times a week, I was to give lunchtime lectures on famous modern pictures in the museum to visitors. I was a graduate student in art history, so I was a natural person to do this job. Given Martha's and my capacity, undiminished to this day, of accelerating from nothing to Parnassus in a microsecond, accelerating from nothing to Parnassus, or at least the basements of the Upper East Side, was what had got us to New York, we saw this job as a good sign, even if it was only a job, sort of. In fact, when we stood in the museum garden, we noticed that there was a good-looking modernist building directly across 54th Street with casement windows and curved Balhausian segments. We were pretty confident that it was used to house bright young gallery lecturers with futures. This, we quickly learned, was not the case. The job, sort of though it was, certainly suited my verbose nature and strange family pedigree. Various lost relations on my father's side of the family, I knew, had once worked as boardwalk pitchmen in Atlantic City, where they would demonstrate, let's say, spray starch for housewives' ironing. They had, as a small boy I had watched them, the habit of starting each spiel in a low-key, friendly manner, attracting a crowd not by a carnival barker intensity, but by high-hearted confidence. They couldn't wait to tell you about the spray starch. I adapted that approach to the pictures at MoMA. I would park myself in front of a famous painting. The Starry Night by Van Gogh was a popular choice. So was Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon. Anything with a story. And just start talking, free associating shamelessly. Don't read the labels, I would call out loudly to the puzzled and docile crowd. No, don't read the labels. If you read the labels, you won't be looking. Come here and let's talk about what we really see. There was enough authority in the cry, and the labels were in any case duller than the pictures, or than some random guy shouting, to draw a small crowd over. Now, like every teacher, cheap or skilled, who promises to talk over or have a discussion about something or other, what I meant was, now you have your chance to listen to me. The labels won't tell you how to look, I'd say. Come and look with me. What was Vincent looking at when he painted this picture? Why a starry night? What did he really see? And off I would go on a careening roller coaster ride with the seatbelts unattached and the old wooden tracks rattling for dear life, of mixed metaphors, rhetorical turns, labored analogies, the whole made remotely decent by the passion with which it was done, which was, I think, real enough. I would say Vincent had a way of looking outside that crucially enabled him to look inside, where others saw pinpricks of light punched in the fabric of a uniform black sky. Van Gogh saw ecstatic spirals and tumbling whorls, a night sky pregnant with possibility that revealed itself in the very act of creation, as though he were a prescient prophet of what only our own age would see in the birth of galaxies and the making of stars that seemed to populate his cosmos as though it were pregnant and laboring to bring forth not just a new art, but an entirely new universe, rooted inside the painter's mind as he struggled to give birth to this new night sky, as a woman struggles in labor to produce a child. Thank you. If I was in a good mood, there wouldn't be a pause for breath. Then I would work round to recite a lovely patch that occurs in Vincent van Gogh's letters, which I had committed to memory, where Vincent talks so beautifully about how illness and suffering and madness might merely be the star tunnels to take us on cosmic trains to another world. Just as magicians learn that the most obvious moves impress people, big talkers learn that anything committed to memory and recited with emotion in an age when nothing is committed to memory will impress people even more than something intelligent, freshly said. I was good at it, and it was the first thing in my life that I had ever been good at. Sending tendrils of words to grow around frames and pictures, interpenetrating stories of artists, lives with a trellis of anecdotes and adjectives, well, this would eventually become my daily work and my comfortable prison. But it was the one thing I did do well at 22, or at least confidently. Speaking in public is, as public speakers know, actually an easy thing to do, even though many people are terrified of speaking in public. I was and remain terrified of most things people are good at, skateboarding or swimming or driving cars, but I wasn't scared of public speaking. Now, not being scared of something, I realize in retrospect, is not a positive virtue. It's mostly a negative one. Being less scared of something than you used to be is a positive virtue, in as much as you have had to work at it. But not being scared in the first place is usually just a sign of a lack of imagination. The people who aren't frightened of climbing vertical rock faces haven't added up the risks and decided to defy them. They just don't feel the risk adequately in the first place, as they note ruefully to themselves as they plunge, as eventually they all do, towards the earth. The person who isn't afraid of public speaking hasn't swallowed his fear in the cause of providing the public with information. He just likes being heard so much that he doesn't notice. The people coming in at lunchtime to hear me, I realized, were hungry for a little bit of humanity. They were coming to the Museum of Modern Art, but they didn't really care about the museum or the modern. They cared about the art. If it had been called the Museum of Modern Artists, they would have liked it more. They didn't want to know anything about the complicated chains of influences and ideas that we had been taught laboriously to overlay on the pictures, we graduate students, I mean. This simplification led to this stylization that led to this abstraction. They wanted to know what had moved the mover. They wanted to know who the poet or painter had broken his heart over, and what he or she had broken her heart against. And this is always, I realize, the most revealing question you can ever ask about anybody's art. Whom was this meant for by the artist, and why were they hoping someone else would love them more for having seen or read it? It could be Shakespeare's father, or John Berryman's mom, or Emily Dickinson's sister-in-law. The one expectant audience holds the key to every pregnant sentence. A Malevich black square, nothing but black, becomes a Joni Mitchell lyric once you know about Mrs. Malevich. Sometimes the same people would come day after day to hear me speak, amid the generally docile crowds of tourists and day trippers, grateful for someone to listen to, amid all the visual confusion. There was a hardcore, now vanished, of MoMA regulars. There was, for instance, the man with the needlepoint Guernica. Not long before the Guernica, Picasso's legendary painting about the bombing of a Spanish city had been repatriated, as the painter had wanted, to a newly democratic Spain. This visitor came up to me after I had talked about a Picasso picture, The Girl Before the Mirror. "It's hard for me to come back here," he said warningly, and then waited for me to take the bait. "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Why?" I said, being constitutionally unable not to take bait when it's offered. "They betrayed us when they moved the Guernica," he said. "I think they sort of had to move it," I said. "The deal was that they would when Spain became a democracy." "Spain's a democracy?" he said. The question didn't take considering. "They didn't have to move it," he insisted. "But I did something about it. I'm reproducing the Guernica in needlepoint, in full color." And he went on to explain that his passion in life was making needlepoint reproductions of Picasso's from the Museum of Modern Art, working from his own photographs. He was a small, burly guy with a spade beard and a thin hairline. And he came back again and again, bringing his little needlepoint frame with him, on which he worked as I spoke. It wasn't rude, just diligent. He kept inviting me over to see his needlepoints. This sounded to me a little suspicious, so failing that, he actually brought photographs of them to show me one lunch hour. He took me into a corner and showed me his album of needlepoint Picassos, photographs slipped under plastic, with a mix of privacy and pride, making it plain to passing would-be gawkers that they weren't invited to this party. He had colorized all the pictures as he turned them into embroidery. The Majolie, a cubist picture, was done in a sort of écru. The Girl Before a Mirror was colored with the reds and yellows of a Spanish medieval apocalypse. The Guernica, which occupied a double fold in his album, was remade in a sort of lime and ochre harmony. It actually looked pretty good in ochre and lime, about as good as it did in black and white. It wasn't presented as a parody, I should add, and God knows its creator didn't think of it that way. Its kitsch was its seriousness. It had the form of a joke, but you weren't meant to laugh at it, not even with the ironic smirk that might have greeted a Lichtenstein cartoon painting. If I had been more prescient than I am, I would have seen the needlepoint Guernica as the first small domino about to fall, or the first small crabgrass on the lawn about to grow, in the appearance of a new kind of art in the 1980s, where all the older kinds of camp and parody got played as straight as Hamlet. Though I didn't know him yet, a young man of a similar spirit was working not far away at the Museum of Modern Art membership desk, and within 5 years, that young man, Jeff Koons, would be presenting life-size kitsch Italian ceramic figurines of cartoon figures with the same desperate sincerity as my needlepoint Guernica maker. But I didn't know that then. There were others like him, lots of them, more than you might ever have imagined, who came again and again to the Museum of Modern Art in search of something that those of us who worked there could hardly name. Two of these passionate listeners stood out from all the rest, and they were Larry and Maxie. Larry came first. He was a tall string bean of a guy in his late 20s in a bad stiff suit. I noticed him standing at the back of the gathering once and then again, and then the following Tuesday again. He gathered up his courage finally and came up to talk. "I really enjoy hearing you," he said. "Tell me, where could I go to learn to talk about pictures?" "You could take art courses at the Met or something," I said, vaguely. "No, I mean to learn to talk about pictures the way you do," he said. I suspect that I was a little offended. "No, I mean it," he said. "Where could I go to become an art historian?" That's what you are, right?" "Well, studying to become one," I said. He looked at me very seriously. "I'm an accountant," he explained, "and I have a whole lyrical aesthetic side that I can't express." He said this bluntly, with an impressive amount of honestly delivered pain. "I'm an accountant," he repeated. "It's hard to be a lyrical person when you're an accountant." I saw that this was probably true, but I felt protective about him anyway, and very reluctantly, over the weeks that passed, I became sort of mentor to him. I bought him a catalog of night school courses at Hunter and instructed him on how to discriminate among them. "Look," I said, "you enjoy coming here to listen and to look at the pictures, and that's the last thing you'll find yourself doing if you become an art historian. Keep that feeling pure. Let it be the pure thing you have." I was, of course, speaking to myself. "You have no idea how terrible it is to be a chartered public accountant," Larry said. He was trying to be amusing, but he was also entirely serious, almost angry with my complacent, patronizing counsel. "I took up accountancy to please my mother, and I want to do something that's better." So I helped him enroll in a class at Hunter, the kind that we called scoffingly Pyramids to Pollock, an overview of man and art from first to last act, and I promised to help him whenever I could with the homework. Maxie Shacknow, the other most frequent visitor, was a more ornery kind. He came to hear me speak, and he said, after listening to me talk about the Starry Night, "You left out the picture he didn't paint." "Well, he painted many kinds of pictures," I said. "F*** that," Maxie said. "There was one picture he never painted." He waited for me to name it, and then, despairing of my denseness, went on. "Vincent van Gogh never painted a portrait of Theo, his brother. He painted his mother. He painted the g*** Berceuse." He meant the woman on a rocker. "He painted the g*** postman twice, for Christ's sake." He meant Joseph Roulin, who van Gogh did indeed paint, and in his postman's uniform several times. "But his brother lived for him and supported him and cared for him when he was sick, and no portrait." "I think they were never together long enough," I said. "Bullshit," Maxie interrupted me. "Excuse my French, that's bullshit. He just never saw that he should. Van Gogh was a great artist and a terrible brother." "Well, many great artists are poor family men," I began. "Family man? That's how you treat your brother? That's not a man. Terrible brother." He fixed me with a gaze. "So I'm doing it," he said at last. "What?" I said. "I'm painting a portrait of Theo in Van Gogh's style, the picture he should have painted, and I'm painting it for him." "I'm doing it in his style," he said, registering the shock in my eyes. "I mean, I wouldn't do it any other style. I mean, a Monet? No. A Degas of Theo? No. A Vincent of Theo. A Van Gogh of Van Gogh, and I'm working on it now." I went to see it later that week. Maxie Shacknow was exhibiting in a street fair down on Washington Square. It was a crowded show with acres of the kind of painting that I had been raised to be contemptuous about. A sign above his painting said, "None of these paintings are for sale." People went back and forth admiring his pastiche Van Gogh's. One woman asked him the price of a road with cypresses, an imitation Van Gogh that he had painted. "That's a Van Gogh, lady," Maxie said, rising from his director's chair. "Offer me $65 million and then we'll talk. $50 for a Van Gogh, the nerve." She withered away. "I know the top dollar for a Van Gogh was $54 million for the irises," Maxie said to me, "but I thought I'd jack up the price for her tone." He looked at the people looking at his pictures. "You look like an educated group," he said. "You remind me of my son. He won a $20,000 scholarship to college from his father. Come look at the Van Goghs." I loved his humor because it was my own. At last, I saw Maxie's portrait of Theo. Not surprisingly, it was a pastiche of elements taken from other Van Gogh pictures. Less skillful in its choices than audacious, there were irises behind his head, as I recall. Vincent's patina of heavy brush strokes became a sort of toothpaste tube application of raw paint. Theo, or Theo's own face, carefully traced from a photograph, looked oddly photographic, but its sincerity was absolute. The forehead, though, was higher, and its brow was smooth. "That's deliberate," Maxie said, following my eye. I didn't potchkey up the paint because I wanted to show what a rock Theo was. What a brother. If you potchkey up the paint the way Vincent did with the postman's beard, it makes it look, you know, like they're on fire or going somewhere. You don't potchkey the paint, and you got a rock. The other painters came round to admire Maxie's pictures and accept his strictures. One of the things I was learning in my time in New York is the insuperable rule of the rabbit hole. If you go into an academic studio in New York City filled with plaster casts, you expect to find the classically minded realist artists embattled and bitter. But they aren't. There are too many of them to be embattled. What they are mostly is amused, the absurdity of the avant-garde being too obvious to need much criticism. The same rule of the foxhole, which states that soldiers fight for other soldiers in the platoon, that we see no farther ahead than five or six other people, means that the force of our competition is with the guy or the girl at the next easel, not with the man two museums away. I met a man later in New York who taught students to paint frescoes in the classic 15th century manner. He didn't care at all what was happening in Soho galleries. He was preoccupied with rumors that another emigre Tuscan might be opening his own fresco studio. A Don Quixote in New York is chiefly annoyed at some other overread Don Quixote muscling in onto his windmills. I finally went for coffee with Maxie. He asked me to. He explained to me that he had been born in Williamsburg but grew up mostly in Brownsville as we had coffee. "I worked as a shoeshine boy and at a slaughterhouse," he told me, "but I always wanted to be an artist. My father made mannequins for Finkelsteins on the Lower East Side, and my mother designed quilts. But always in the back of my mind, you know, there's this picture of Van Gogh's called the Langlois Bridge. I saw it when I was young, you know. So even my wife told me, get off the damn ham radio and find another hobby. So I took painting classes, and I painted one picture after another, and then another, and now I paint 7 days a week, every minute I can take from the business. I've painted 1,245 Van Goghs. I know the number for certain, because I number every one. Then he coughed slightly and looked forward. What's my painting worth? He asked. Sorry, of course I had heard him, but I needed a moment to think it through. What's it worth? My Van Gogh. My portrait of Theo Van Gogh. What's it worth to a museum like yours? Like mine. And I realized that he thought that my lunchtime presence was a sign of my value to the museum. I had been courted not for my wit, but for my access to power. What's it worth? The best answer, of course, was try not to be unrealistic. It really isn't the sort of thing any museum would ever buy. But we are all too cowardly to say such things or too courteous. It's priceless. It's yours, I said at last. I thought that the sententious obviousness of the response might be seen through instantly, as Vincent has seen through Theo. But Maxie seemed to find it satisfactory. Yeah, I know, he said. I'll never sell it. Someday, I'm going to have my own museum, Maxie's museum. Not outside in an art fair with walls and all that crap. A real one, and I'll put it there. I smiled, and the picture was still there 4 or 5 years later. Then years went by, and eventually I would tell people stories about Maxie whenever I had an occasion to go to a museum and talk about Van Gogh, to illustrate the extraordinary connection that simple people had with this very complicated painter. Not long ago, when he came to mind again, as I was thinking about my early years in New York, I did what no one could have done 30 years ago. I Googled him. And I was stunned. No, I was astonished. I plotzed, as Maxie would have said, to find out that there had been a Maxie Shacknow Museum. Not a makeshift arrangement in the art firms, fairs, but one that actually existed. A now defunct but still existing webpage showed that Maxie had opened a museum of his own on his retirement to Florida. There it was, the Shacknow Museum of Fine Arts, 7080 Northwest 4th Street in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He had done it after all. He had made a museum to show his pictures in. The portrait of Theo must have ended up there. And he must have had money that he had made in the garment industry to do it. Small potatoes by New York art world standards, I suppose, but a big enough benefactor to open the Maxie Museum in New York. He had become, I realized in a shaming moment, an anecdote, I told, but I had missed the range and power of his real vision. He had not only painted the missing portrait of Theo, he had built a museum to hang it in, and then had died with his work intact. He had done what Vincent dreamed of doing, and had done it better. And then the story took one final strange turn. About 5 years ago, in 2011, a Dutch art historian discovered that a self-portrait of Vincent that had been in the Amsterdam Museum for years was, in truth, a portrait of his brother. He had painted a portrait of Theo, after all. It existed all along. I felt a small, regressive, smug triumph. They had been looking at the labels, and it had been a mistake. The portrait of Theo was hidden in plain sight. And the reason it had been accepted for a century as a self-portrait of Vincent was that, though distinguishable from Vincent by a set of infinitesimal clues that took a century and more to unravel, in almost every respect, Vincent had made his brother indistinguishable from himself. The actual portrait, hidden in plain sight for so long, was of a man who bled into his brother's image, or was perhaps trapped in his brother's shadow, an invisible man, even in his own portrait. There was, I think now, some strange moral equation of ambition and absurdity and self-obsession, of self-assertion and self-denial, in the intersection of Maxie and Vincent and Theo and my various ambitions. They provoked in me an act of moral and aesthetic accounting I still seem unable to conclude. Maxie was absurd, certainly, for thinking that he could be Van Gogh, but then Vincent had been absurd to everyone but Theo in thinking that he could be Van Gogh. No one took him seriously either. Maxie had been most like Van Gogh in his least Van Gogh-like enterprises. The comic egotism of his pursuit of seeing Theo and painting Theo was like the heroic egotism of Vincent's pursuit of being Vincent. And yet, Maxie's portrait of Theo looked like a picture painted by Maxie, because it was so dutifully selfless, a catalog of Theo's traits and treasures as Vincent might have imagined them. Vincent's actual portrait of Theo looked like Vincent because Vincent, being a real artist, was above all occupied with the mystery of himself. He was entirely hidden within his brother's face, under his own hat. Our attempts to make art pious by pretending that artists are selfless, or even self-denying, is always phony. That isn't the way art works. It's a series of egotistical assertions, like my own. Rooms in Maxie's museum, some of which turn out, by the strange alchemy of the architecture of the self we call art, to be places where we all can live. Oh, Larry. You're wondering about Larry. Years later, rummaging through art magazines, I was startled to see his name on a paper, duly footnoted, about something. Russian constructivism, I think. And I saw my name in the footnotes. There's always something frightening about seeing one's own name in unexpected print. It always has the look of a legal indictment. My heart stopped when I saw that there was a reference at the end dismissively to something I'd written. Gopnik here makes the error, or Gopnik sneers at. It was, I realized, the eternal exchange between writers and scholars, between those of us who are basically here to tell tales and those who are out to find facts. He had become my story, but I had become his footnote. Thank you very much. That's a new story. Wanted to tell, before I stop for questions, I wanted to tell one last story. If you may, you up for it? I know I've been talking a lot. This is another story about Luke and about communication and what we experience. I told you about my grandfather at the beginning of the evening. And one of the things that was memorable about my grandfather was that, like all Jewish men of his generation, the things he loved best in life were his family and a schwitz. Schwitz is a steam bath. When I was a little boy, my grandfather worked on the docks. I don't mean he was a stevedore. He had a wholesale fish business on the docks in Philadelphia, and I would pretend to help him in his business, and then he would take me for a steam bath at the end of the day. And this was my idea of the perfect life, was to be a wholesale fish man who then went for a steam bath, because he would sit in the schwitz with a towel wrapped around himself with guys named Maxie and Benny and Joe and Sam and Sydney, names you never, all the Sydneys I know now are little girls, six-year-old girls in ballet classes. And they would all groan together. They would just groan, beautiful groans. And I realized that that was a wonderful thing to be, was to be a groaning Jewish man of that earlier generation. Because really, we diminish as the generations go on. There are groaning Jews like my grandfather, and then there are kind of whining Jews like Woody Allen or my father, complain a lot or obsessed about, nervous in lots of ways. And I realized that my real ambition in life was to go from being a whining Jew to being a groaning Jew. And the way that you do this is through steam baths, essentially. A lot of steam in your life will make you that. And so I wanted to introduce Luca, my son, who was getting ready to go off to college, to this great ritual, this coming-of-age ritual. So we joined a health club together in New York, and we went there, and we worked out. He worked out. I pretended to work out. And then we put our towels on, and there was a steam room in this gym. That was why I was drawn to it. I was taken with it. And we go in together, and I'm keenly looking forward to having the chance to take part in this ritual, man to boy to man to boy. And I open the door to the steam room, and I notice that there are two men inside the steam room having sex in the steam room. And I back out. Pull Luca back with me. Luke's 17 at this point. And I'm indignant at being cheated of generational steam with my son. And then I ask myself if I should complain. Now, this is the kind of question that only occurs to liberal-minded people, right? We agonize over these sorts of questions. And the only way we're able to do it is transitively. So you don't say to yourself, that was inappropriate. You say, what if it had been a man and a woman having sex in the steam room? Would I have been offended then? And if you can answer that question positively, then you have a right to be offended. Then you're not being homophobic, then you're just being self-righteous. And we always want to be self-righteous, and we never want to be homophobic or bigoted in any way. So with that conviction firmly implanted in my mind, I went down to protest to the manager of the gym. But I had to make it plain that what I was protesting was the general inappropriateness of what was going on, not the specifically homoerotic nature of it. So I started with a long preamble, longer than the preamble of the Constitution, saying, you should understand, my son's name is Luke Auden. He's named after a great gay poet. I am, by training, an art historian, by occupation, an art critic, and I write musical theater on the side. I am essentially a gay man locked inside a heterosexual identity. The manager has no idea what I'm talking about at this point. I explain the problem. Inappropriate, have men making love in the steam room. He said, oh, it's terrible. We'll put a sign up to prevent this. Put a sign up. And as I'm leaving, we're leaving the gym, Luca turns to me. He's taller than I am, head taller than I am. Good-looking boy. And he says, what were you talking to the man about, Dad? He has a deep voice, too, deeper than mine. He's really not whining. And I said, oh, it was nothing. It was nothing, Luca. Nothing. He said, oh, you were talking about the two guys having sex in the steam room. I said, yeah, I was. He said, yeah, that was awkward. And I lit up because that was such a beautiful word, awkward. Such a beautiful word to use to describe that situation. It wasn't inappropriate. Inappropriate was a whining word to use to describe it. It wasn't immoral. That was a censorious word to use. It was awkward. And I realized how generationally, how advanced we had become. What wonderful moral generation the one coming after us is, because they don't see the world in terms of these meaningless categories of appropriate and inappropriate, in terms of these whining judgments of wrong and right. And they just see the world in two terms. Things are random, meaning happening for no particular reason, and things are awkward. Things are awkward. And I realize there's really nothing in existence that you can't capture with those two beautiful categories. It was random or it was awkward. I went back a week later to the gym by myself. Luca had left for college. I was alone. And I go back to the steam room. And indeed, a giant sign has been put up saying any inappropriate behavior in this steam room will be met with instant expulsion. And I open the door, and there's a room full of guys tightly wrapped up in their towels, and they're looking at me as the guy who shut down the good time. So I did the only thing a Jewish man can do in that situation. I sat down, and I groaned. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for coming.
That was Adam Gopnik speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2016. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for the Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.